Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Barry Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with poet and artist John Brandy about the art of haiku, and Tom Leach, who's the director of the Palace Press, will be with us as well. I'd like now to welcome Benjamin Binstock. He is professor of art history at Cooper Union in New York City, and he's the author of the new book, Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius, Discovery, and the Unknown Apprentice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
Now, the great Dutch painter, 17th century Dutch painter, Johannes Vermeer, is considered to be one of the greatest painters in the history of art, but he was only, I guess, moderately successful in his lifetime, and then was pretty much forgotten. How and when was he discovered or rediscovered and given the status that he now holds in art history?
That was in the 19th century, actually around 1859, 1860, and it's something that scholars debate. I would say the reason why is because that was really the beginning of modern art history. There was a man called Théophile Thoré who was a political activist, and he actually was writing under a pseudonym. He had to be in exile from Paris, and that's when he was hanging out in Holland. He started looking at the museums and writing about them, and that's when he made his discovery of this incredible unrecognized genius. Maybe earlier people saw that, but this was the time when they had art journals with mass circulation, when they had photographs, when they were starting to do exhibitions. So the fact that Vermeer was recognized as being such an important painter at the outset of the modern discipline of art history kind of shows you that's what art history is when we have the capacity to circulate photographs, to collect together paintings, we start looking at things that were made in the 17th century or 16th earlier, but couldn't have been received in that way in their own time.
There's also the sense of some artists being ahead of their time and not their greatness is not even recognized at that time because people's sensibilities hadn't caught up with them.
I would say all great art is necessarily ahead of its time or, let's say, beyond its time. I mean, it's got the historical context it was created in, but what these people do is when they create works of genius, it's just got so much in them, like with Shakespeare. I mean, he was ahead of his time, too, in a certain way, and we continue to plumb his works. The case of Vermeer, though, is exemplary of this belated discovery, and it really is still debated whether there was a rediscovery. I think he was practically, he was unknown outside his town, pretty much, and in his own town, there was a patron who bought most of his works, but because that was a private collection, most people didn't see the paintings at all, so he couldn't really be known.
Now, only 37 paintings attributed to Vermeer survive. Why so relatively few? I mean, he did die fairly young, but still, that's not a lot of paintings.
That's right. It's possibly the smallest oeuvre life work of any major artist in the Western canon. That has partly to do with Vermeer being so meticulous and taking so much time for thinking through what he was doing. And it was also his life strategy. He wasn't successful. He lived with his mother-in-law. He married a Catholic girl, probably converted. It was a kind of persecuted minority. You had to hide your religion and your churches inside your house because it was a Protestant Dutch Republic. But they had money, so he married into this family who kind of supported them. He lived off of them. He had this patron who was paying him something for the right of first refusal and probably producing about two paintings a year. So he set things up so that he was able to devote himself to his art. He didn't get rich. He wasn't successful, but he did what he wanted to do, which is make the greatest paintings possibly that anyone's ever made. And only, depending on who you ask, 31, 37 extant paintings.
Right. Oh, well, and that's something we'll get to in a moment. The subjects of Vermeer's paintings, as you write, were his family, his house, his city, and not for the most part heroic subject matter or religious or heavily symbolic. What was he up to? What did it mean at that time to paint simply the people and places of everyday life?
Well, that was what we call genre painting, which is a word that they invented in 18th, 19th century, French word genre, meaning categories, all these different categories, landscape, still life, interior scene. This was the popular idiom of the time. Interestingly, in Vermeer's time, it was considered a low art form, a popular art form, and not high status like history painting, religious painting. And Vermeer started out as a history painter doing biblical scenes, but turned to his native idiom. And again, this has everything to do with this belatedness and this later discovery, because we now think of genre painting as the great painting of the period. A further distinction should be made between other genre painters who were painting, for example, domestic scenes of domestic interiors, people inside rooms. I claim that I'm the one that claims that Vermeer's families or members are in his paintings. That was said by some earlier scholars, but recent scholars don't really address the topic, and it's never been systematically addressed. And I say that Rembrandt and Vermeer, the two greatest painters, were the greatest genre painters precisely because they turned to the world around them. They were so much in tune with their own experience and their families, the people that they knew intimately. That's why when they do scenes of everyday life, they're most compelling for us, because it was something immediate and intimate.
Immediate and intimate, and there was a tremendous amount of love there.
That's right. Love is a crucial thing in Vermeer's painting, and women is a crucial part of Vermeer's painting. He was living in a household. There was a psychotic brother-in-law who makes kind of indirect appearances, in the paintings, but mostly there was his wife, his mother-in-law, his elder daughters. He had 9 children, but most of them were women and daughters, female, and the ones that he really got to interact with, the ones that really got to serve as models in his paintings, because they were the only ones who were going to be old enough, his two eldest daughters towards the end of his career. So love of a father for a daughter, the more complicated love of a man for his wife and back, and the very complicated relationship to one's mother-in-law.
And these are all in here. I mean, besides looking at the painting of Vermeer, you look, and the book, really addresses the scholarship and the history of Vermeer scholarship. And there have been so many. It seems like everybody is kind of carving out their little territorial niche in having opinions about whether or not this person was his daughter, and whether or not this obviously pregnant woman is actually pregnant or not, and so on. You seem to take an approach of simplifying and calling obvious things for what they are.
I try to do that. I hope that the truth is simply obvious. Now, there's a distinction to be made between something like my very controversial argument that we're going to get to, that his daughter did some of the paintings, and that's something that's... I have no problem with that being controversial. I don't even have problem with my colleagues denying it or resisting it. But the funny thing is, for example, if that woman is pregnant, how can you deny these paintings with a woman's distended stomach? And Van Gogh saw it. He said, "Do you know," in a letter to his friend, I think it was Emile Bernard, "do you know that painting with the beautiful Dutch woman who's pregnant?" But scholars, there's a side of them that can be counterintuitive, because people also like to disagree with what was said before them, so that
right,
they're saying something new. But how they can, it's like what they say, you can question paternity, but how can you question maternity? A pregnant woman is clearly, she's doing something,
Right. Well, and it does, it's interesting, because it does show that sometimes scholarship kind of comes full circle. I mean, you were going back and finding pearls of wisdom in scholarship that happened 100 years ago, and a lot of stuff that came in between seems now to be, at least by you, discredited.
I wouldn't want to overly simplify that, black and
right,
white. It's cumulative, and there's no way that I could have said any of the things that I said without the whole history of scholarship up to and including the last couple of things that were been published, and we all build on it. But yes, there's a certain, first of all, I'm very interested in going back and reading what earlier scholars said, which I often think, sometimes they may have gotten something slightly wrong, and people throw the whole thing out. It's like the problem of biography. A lot of time that's been exaggerated or genius. People have made kind of crude formulas, but that doesn't mean throw out biography and genius. For me, that's the essence. But you may be thinking in particular is that one painting The Little Street, and interestingly, the very first identification of what that house is, and the painting has been considered a riddle, all of us written about it. The very first one was Vermeer's house, which is the most obvious, but he got the location wrong. And you see, you make a mistake like that, everybody says, well, it can't be Vermeer's house. Then they spend the whole time searching for what it could possibly be, and yes, I like to call it hermeneutics of the obvious. I mean, don't discount the obvious when you're trying to interpret something.
Well, you've done a very interesting thing, which is you've laid out a kind of floor plan of Vermeer's house and then shown these exquisite interiors that everybody who's seen his work or seen reproductions of his work knows and kind of mapped them onto this floor plan of the house. And you've also done something that I guess has never been done before, namely put Vermeer's work in chronological order. Describe the process of doing this and why hasn't it been done before?
Well, I like to say that a crucial part of this is how you use, for example, illustrations. You can't really understand Vermeer's development and the painting-by-painting development unless you can compare paintings with each other. But the funny thing, if you look at books before mine, most art history books, they like to have big pictures, so there'll be one picture per page. And it's a common in Vermeer monographs that you'll see this one work after another, but what you can't do is compare them. So there's a way that you don't put them in order, or you don't see that the order doesn't make sense because you're not really trying. And I also secondly say it's a chicken and egg question, which is if you don't see that some of them don't belong, you won't be able to put them in order because it doesn't make sense. You couldn't put them in order. There's no coherent order you could put them in. And conversely, unless you put them in order, you're not going to recognize that some of them don't belong. On a broader level, all of this for me, all of the threads tie back together, that you recognize family members in paintings, that you recognize that his work is about his own environment, his house, his family life, that you recognize he was developing painting by painting. All of those threads can be tied back to what I consider the reality from which he was producing, because he really did paint his paintings in a certain order, and he really did use certain models. I don't like to think that it's too abstruse that I'm bringing all of these different perspectives onto the paintings. I'm really just trying to get back to what the ground of the production of those works were.
So you make the case that seven, and again, the number of paintings that are attributed to Vermeer changes a little bit as art history progresses, but you make the case that I guess seven of Vermeer's 37 surviving paintings were actually done by Vermeer's daughter, Maria. How did you come to this?
Well, actually, it was a long, slow process. I think as an undergraduate at Berkeley, I already felt some of those paintings didn't belong. And even in graduate school at Columbia, I didn't know who could have painted them. And I saw that they were pastiches, what we call pastiches, that they were put together from works by Vermeer. Some of these paintings are literally pieced together from other works by Vermeer, and Vermeer didn't work that way. He always reinvented whatever he was painting. He reconceived it. But I didn't know who it could be. There were reproductions of these things from before Vermeer really was even discovered, because a couple of his works were known even though they weren't considered important. And that didn't make sense, because why would somebody be forging them that early? And the funny thing was, it was in a class I was teaching, a student, Iranian girl, it's a painting, it's on my wall here in my apartment, and I call it Iranian Revolutionary Interrupted. She based her own self-portrait on a painting called Girl Interrupted in the Frick Collection in New York. And it was a self-portrait, and I realized there, when she brought that in, I thought, oh my God, she's put her self-portrait in the place of another woman artist doing her self-portrait, and it all just fell into place.
And so some of the pictures, if you're correct, Vermeer's famous girl with a red hat is actually a self-portrait by his daughter. And it's once I read this in your book, and then I was thinking of when I was an undergraduate, I studied art history in college, and I wrote a paper on Rembrandt's self-portraits, and you put this out, and then suddenly that is very reminiscent of Rembrandt's self-portraits. And I find myself wanting to ask you, are self-portraits in 17th century Dutch painting distinguishable from portraits of other people? Is it its own distinct genre?
Sure. It's a genre with its own evolution, to which Rembrandt contributed massively. I mean, he kind of reinvented the self-portrait. And the funny thing is, with all art, there's both the question of the historical invention of new genres like self-portrait and our belated understanding of them. And you understand that, for example, a self-portrait has to be recognized. Most self-portraits are recognized late, that they're just pictures of somebody, of a man or a woman, and we realize, oh, that's a self-portrait because you recognize certain qualities, some maybe bloodshot eyes or the nature of the stare, the one focused eye, or the exotic hats, the informality, the way the arm is leaning, for example, the way you'd paint in front of a mirror, all of which, for example, apply to the girl with the red hat. One of the things I'm saying is, although I belatedly recognize, wow, that's a self-portrait, that's not unusual. A lot of Rembrandt self-portraits of the famous Man with the Red Turban by Jan van Eyck, that was later recognized. There's nothing on it that says this is a self-portrait. There's no document that says, I, Jan van Eyck, painted this self-portrait in a red turban. I even suggest in my book that there's another earlier painting by Robert Campin, who's a predecessor of van Eyck, where he's wearing a red turban, hasn't been recognized as a self-portrait, and I suggest that's a self-portrait. So it's a cultural construct to recognize these self-portraits. But the other thing is that it's cumulative. So one of the things you mentioned, I think Maria Vermeer was looking at Rembrandt's self-portraits when she made that red hat. And I'm not the only one to say that. Earlier scholars have said this painting seems to be based on Rembrandt's self-portraits. Scholars have even said it looks like a self-portrait, but they didn't know what to do with that because it was a woman and it was supposed to be by Vermeer.
Now, was this picture always recognized as being a portrait of Vermeer's daughter?
The red hat, no. It's been suggested, there's one unusual book, it's an Italian version of the collected works, and for some reason the fellow in there says he thinks it's Vermeer's youngest daughter, which I noted must be a typo, because his youngest daughter was about 4 years old. I think he may have meant the eldest daughter, and if that's what he meant, then I agree with him. The Girl with the Pearl Earring, which is another one, famous painting that the novel, Tracy Chevalier's novel, was based on, and the film with Scarlett Johansson, now it's a play. I think that was also Maria Vermeer, the eldest daughter, and you can compare those two to see the features are similar. You know, they're two different artists, the father idealizing the daughter as a kind of beautiful object, and the daughter confronting herself with a frank realism as a creative subject. I mean, it's very interesting to see all of this. Some of these things have been suggested before. I mean, there's a long history of scholarship, and people say this and that. And I find there's all kinds of insights that anticipate my arguments. Sometimes there's contradictions or things that people say that anticipate it. I don't think that you can really talk about paintings without being part of this long conversation that is the history of scholarship or even popular works.
We're talking to Benjamin Binstock, author of the book Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius, Discovery, and the Unknown Apprentice. Well, if this is true, Maria Vermeer was a fabulous painter.
Yes.
Why do you think she started painting, and why did she stop?
Well, I think it was unusual, you know, women painters in the 17th century. We have a couple, but even some of the ones we know about, one of the most famous, Judith Leyster, she stopped painting when she married another painter who, I think most people would agree, isn't as good a painter as she was. But the role of the woman was to have children and take care of the household. It was very, very unusual for women to be able to survive in professional life, even more of an unlevel playing field than it is now. And I think that Vermeer's eldest daughter, she was his model, and she was the girl with the pearl earring, and she must have seen the majority of her father's works in the patron's collection. It was a couple blocks away. I know that Vermeer went and visited. I know from her paintings that she went and visited. They were looking at this, and she saw that she was kind of the star of her father's collection. She was probably helping him as an assistant, perhaps, to grind paint. They were under great money trouble, so he couldn't afford an assistant, and he didn't have any official students. He didn't have any formal students. May have had partly to do with his living in this Catholic family. But so it makes perfect sense that she would have helped him, and she was his model. And it seems to me that if you're an intelligent young woman, you don't want to just be the beautiful model. You want to give it a try. She clearly had great talent. And what I think happened partly is when she tried out some things, maybe the red hat, little panel, or the girl with the flute, her father might not have even known about that. You know, there are little self-portrait studies that she could have somehow made, maybe. But I think once she made those, he must have realized, wow, she has talent. And then another part of the story, if you'll let me, is I think because they were under such financial duress, they had great debts. Vermeer planned it out so that he could kind of survive, but towards the end of his life, the debts were mounting just for bread, the family daily bread. He was running up a huge bill with the baker that had to be paid. That baker was traded two paintings by Vermeer's wife after his death to settle the debt, said to be Vermeer paintings. I think those are Maria Vermeer paintings. I think they must have known that ahead of time and deliberately kept her apprenticeship a family secret. Small town, they couldn't let that get out. They knew they were going to have to give the baker something. And I think she basically forged her father's works.
Do you think that as she was doing them, she was doing forgeries to pay debts, or was she just painting?
I think she started painting at first. There's a work by work, you know, those two early self-portraits, I think she did for herself. And those are brilliant. They're creative. Then I think she did a portrait that's now in the Met that I think passed into the patron's collection. I think he allowed one Maria Vermeer symbolically to enter his collection. That would also explain the disparity of the fact that during the patron's lifetime, there were 20 Vermeer works. But when they were sold by his son-in-law eventually died and they were sold at auction, there were 21 Vermeer works. Where did that extra Vermeer come from? I think they knew it wasn't a Johannes Vermeer. So then that was the third. By the fourth painting, I think she already did something that ended up in the baker's hands, and it also directly responds to a painting that the baker already owned. For me, that's evidence that she was deliberately, and to see that, she had to go over to the baker and look at the painting. I mean, she must have been going to pick up the bread for the family. But I think by that point, they must have realized she could pass off paintings. So I think they are technically forgeries.
In the world of handwriting analysis, it turns out that it's much easier for a family member to forge a signature than for a non-family member to do so. And it's very hard to verify that false signature is a forgery when it's done by the person's brother or child. And I wonder if the same is true for painting. Does the child of a painter have a genetic ability to pass off a painting as their father's painting?
Well, actually, only three of these works, problem works that I'm saying are by his eldest daughter, are signed, and they're signed in irregular ways. So it doesn't really pose a problem. Each case is different. Some of these could be later forgeries. They could have been her own signing it in order to pass it off.
I don't mean just the signature, but the painting itself.
Oh, that's a very interesting idea. The relation. There's no question that we know we have lots of famous cases of families of painters, and clearly, she had some of the same genetic material. I think. And she was brilliant, as you say. She was a Vermeer. I think she was a genius. I think she's got a very different vision. I think she's much bolder, much more expressive, much more of a risk taker. I think she does have lots of technical difficulties and inconsistencies that make sense for a beginning painter that don't make any sense for a painter like Vermeer, who was at the top of his game and one of the greatest painters in the history of art. But you're absolutely right that she had that Vermeer DNA, and she also was the guy's only student. I mean, she was living there. She grew up watching him paint, and she interacted with him. I say that she even influenced him. His last paintings are borrowing some of her ideas. That's something Vermeer, they call him the Sphinx of Delft, partly because There's something uncanny about his ability to synthesize the best ideas of everyone, including Rembrandt, his great predecessor, Carl Fabricius, all of his peers. Vermeer was a real synthesizer, and I think he stole something from his daughter at the end of his life, too.
I have to say, I love the way that, you know, as you mentioned, in the book, instead of having big pictures isolated on a page, you have lots of pictures on a page, and they're smaller, but when you compare the pictures that you claim Vermeer made of his daughter and then that she made of herself, there really is a distinction. I mean, the pictures of the daughter by the father are very sweet, and the ones of the if they are really self-portraits, the self-portraits of the young woman by herself are much more, I guess, sort of womanly and not quite so sweet.
It's interesting. One of the things I mention is that in the conventional titles, a lot of these paintings by the father are called Girl With This or That. And a lot of the paintings of just by the daughter have conventionally been known as Woman With So and So. And I mean, sometimes it's about hairstyle that the father likes to present the girl sometimes with a slightly more girlish hairstyle with pigtails, and she seems to have resisted that. But it's also about how a woman is presented. I do think there's a fundamental difference between a male artist, for example, looking at a woman as an object of desire, and a female artist who's naturally going to look at a woman differently, as something, maybe another subjectivity interacting with her own.
Or a daughter, which is, we hope, not even a subject of desire, an object of desire.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit. You know, there's been all of this speculation. So, for example, the Tracy Chevalier, when she wrote The Pearl Girl with a Pearl Earring, she made up, it's explicit, supposed to be a fiction, it's in the blind spot of art history, that it's supposed to be this maid's assistant that Vermeer is lusting after. And they make it explicit, you know, in the film, he's kind of, there's that famous poster where, I think, Colin Farrell is, or Firth, I always get them mixed up. I know it's Scarlett Johansson, but he's kind of leaning on her shoulder. I think that a father maybe sees his wife, who he erotically desires, displaced and kind of purified and joined with himself. It's a mystery, as the Christians say. I don't know. I don't have a daughter. I hope I might still have one. But I can imagine that there's a mix of these feelings. She's also the offspring of this wife who you make love to, and you made love to create this daughter. I mean, it's a strange situation, isn't it?
So let's move on. We've got just a little bit of time left. How does a change in attribution, for example, if your theory spreads around the world of art history and it's the most radical theory and everybody debates it, and then it becomes generally accepted, and certainly there's a long history of changes of attribution of paintings over the centuries of art history. When a change of attribution becomes accepted, what does that do to the way a painting is valued, not only financially, but as a work of art in a value in a museum's collection?
Well, it should change it. I mean, that's partly because all of the values, monetary and cultural and political, that we now assign to paintings are a function of the way we look at them. We like to think that we're objectively representing what they historically were, but we change our minds. We have our own perspective. I hope that Maria Vermeer, if she's recognized as an artist and people are looking into this, her paintings could potentially rise in value because she would be one of the great woman artists who was kind of cut off early, but it certainly should make them more interesting. They raise up from being problem works by Vermeer that don't seem to be up to his standard to works by a different artist with a different sensibility, who's trying to do different things. I mean, a little bit like the way they used to say Roman art was a bad version of Greek art, until we learned to understand that Roman art had its own very interesting things it was doing.
So you, as we've talked about in the book, really go through the history of Vermeer scholarship, and I was wondering, there are so many approaches that people use to look at paintings and other works of art, and philosophical and cultural and sociological schools of thought. How do you teach your students to look at, study, and write about, and become scholars of art?
Well, it's funny. My last class that I taught last term, they asked me to teach a kind of methods, or what's called Western theories of art. So we looked at all of the different ways. I would say if somebody's got some insights, definitely look. I mean, Marxists, look at politics, look at money, consider that, psychoanalysis, sexuality. All of these things I think are very important. One of the things that I stress in my classes, though, I don't feel you can get anywhere unless you really take formalism seriously, what I would call a discipline of formalism, which is caring about the visual qualities of works, the visual elements, how an artist develops, what makes an artist's work their own work, which is related to biography, the idea of the oeuvre, and so on. I would say that's the ground of art history. And it seems to me you don't really have to choose between one method or another. It should be synthetic, but I think it should all be brought back to bear on what makes a work of art distinct, which is its visual qualities, the idiosyncratic vision of an individual artist, the conceptual, the technical, formal qualities, and that is related in turn to what I would say genius. I mean, that's why we're looking at these things. They're great documents of history, but what they're most importantly is works of individual genius. It's like music history or literary history. That's where I would associate art history. It's got to be seen as something that's about aesthetic vision.
Benjamin Binstock is a professor of art history at Cooper Union in New York City. He is the author of the new book, Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius, Discovery, and the Unknown Apprentice. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking about the Palace Press and about haiku. Please stay tuned to KSFR.